The following wrestling exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Indeed it does. From the Polyester Pleasure Palace on the shores of Lake Washington, or as close as I can get in my price range, it is Jim Valley, the show Wrestling Road Stories. Back when the beer was cold, the rats were hot, people believed it was real, and we sold out everywhere. Everywhere! Yes, indeed, Wrestling Road Stories. Remember, 4 out of 5 trailer parks approve. Ask your doctor if Wrestling Road Stories is right for you. Hey, we're back, and we're going to have a lot of fun today. Very excited. On the show today, Tennessee, East Tennessee, the King of Kingsport, Bo James is going to be on the show. And as I've mentioned before, I am fascinated by Memphis wrestling. I'm fascinated by it. It's just, it's the best. And I've sort of, after I read Brennan Martin's book, even though it was a story about Christine Jarrett talking about Memphis, obviously, but he talks a lot about Nick Goulas and George Goulas and everything, and it kind of got me reinterested in the East Tennessee side of the territory, which I don't really know a lot about. I have a working knowledge, but not a tremendous amount of knowledge. So I found Bo James, and he's going to come on, and we'll talk about some great stories. We'll talk about the Fullers and the Welches. We'll talk about the Goulas family, Nick and George Goulas. And we'll talk about the Poffos. You know, they ran East Tennessee as the ICW. So talk about a lot of different things as far as that goes. So that'll be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to talking with Bo James here in just a couple of minutes. If you do want to call in, talk to Bo James, you can at area code 515-605-9345. You just push 1, I think, to call in. I'll check with Ryan. I think that's what you do. 515-605-9345 if you want to call in, or you can find me on Twitter at Jim Valley, and again, Facebook as well. You can add me on Facebook. Just send me a message, particularly if we don't have the same friends or your settings. Don't let me look. I think I've got a couple of people who listen to the show, but I'm not positive, and I just don't want the webcam girls. I just don't want the spam. I'm happy to add you. Love to add you. So if you're on the Facebook, go ahead and add me on Facebook, but just shoot me a quick message. Just let me know that you're not a webcam girl. It's so many webcam girls. Isn't that over by now? But I don't know. You'd think that would just have diminishing returns after a while because it's been around for so long, that scam. But I guess the Nigerian thing is still around, so the Nigerian prince deal. So why not webcam girls still? So anyway, so add me on Facebook, don't be a webcam girl, or I'm also on Instagram, it's at Jim_Valley, you can find me on Instagram, and by the way, this is going to be, if you haven't added me on social, this is the week to do it, and I'm not joking, because I'm not going to be here doing the show live the next couple of weeks. We'll have a show next week with the historian J. Michael Kenyon, who died a few months ago from my Total Chaos days from 2001, I think is when I talked to J. Michael Kenyon. I think he was one of the last Total Chaos shows I did. But we'll talk with J. Michael next week on a taped interview from 2001. And then the week after that, we'll have Steve Corino and Roddy Piper, I think, on a show from Portland. So be sure to listen to those. And it's a great idea. There's a ton of my Total Chaos shows there that I have uploaded if you're a VIP member. So be sure to check out pwtorch.com/goVIP. If you like what you hear with the Total Chaos shows, if you like the one from a couple of weeks ago with Tom Zenk, there are more Tom Zenk shows. I talked to him 2 or 3 times. So there's more Tom Zenk if you're a VIP member. And there's a ton with a whole bunch of other people. I mean, I talked to pretty much every major star with maybe the exception of like Stone Cold and Vince pretty much. I mean, I talked to everybody back then. Everybody. So do that. But here's why you need to add me. Because next week, I'm going to go on a 2-week trip to Asia. So if you like theme parks like me, we're going to go, my wife and I are going to go to Hong Kong Disneyland. We're going to go to Shanghai Disneyland. And then we're going to go to Tokyo Disneyland and Tokyo Disney Sea. And Tokyo Disney Sea, SEA, Tokyo Disney Sea is the coolest theme park in the world. But not only that, even if you don't like theme parks, you should add me because I am going to be hooking up with my friend, wrestling legend, one of the most legendary historians and writers probably living today. Maybe number one. In my mind, he might be number one. Fumi Saito. He was on a podcast a couple of months ago with Medusa. He helped Medusa a lot when she was in Japan. He helps a lot of guys in Japan. So I'm going to hook up with Fumi. So follow me on social for that. But not only that, we are going to go to, I don't know if it's a bar or restaurant, but we're going to go to the establishment that is now run by Bull Nakano. The Bull Nakano. How awesome is that? So follow me next week at Jim Valley on Twitter, or just look for me, Jim Valley, on Facebook, Kirkland, Washington. There's another Jim Valley in Washington who is my cousin, who was in the famous 60s band Paul Revere and the Raiders. So don't bother that Jim Valley. He's a nice man. He's a great guy, but he doesn't want your wrestling crap. He's an old hippie who likes nice, beautiful things, and we don't need to scare him off with our wrestling. But so next week, be sure to follow me on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, at Jim Valley. Jim Valley on Facebook, or Jim_Valley if you're on Instagram or Insta, as the kids say. So there's a couple of things I wanted to talk about this week. And, you know, with this show, we'd like to tell crazy stories about the past, but also I like to tie things in from the past into the future. And a couple of things people have been talking about. For one, the Triple Mania 25, when Dr. Wagner lost his mask. Everyone told me he was going to lose his mask, but it was still shocking to me when he did it, because he's historically so difficult to work with. And I wouldn't have been surprised if he would have pulled the power play at the end and something would have happened, but he lost his mask. Amazing. It blew me away. It was cool to see it on Twitch for live. And by the way, Kevin Gill, I don't know if he probably is not even listening to this. I'm probably not even on his radar. You know, I'm a bit of an announcer myself. I actually went to the WWE, had an audition to be an announcer. The job did go to Todd Grisham, but I did come in second. So that was pretty good. But so, you know, I kind of know what I'm talking about, you know, and I hope he does better next time. I'm not criticizing him, but man, you know, he really didn't, to me, capture the feeling of the product, the excitement, nor did he really explain things well enough, because there's probably, you know, obviously there's a lot of hardcore fanboys who are always going to know more than whoever is calling the match. There's always going to be that group and you can't please them, but I just felt like he didn't do a good enough job getting things across to the casual fan, and I hope he does. I really do. My fingers are crossed. He seems like a cool guy, and I'm happy for anybody who is able to succeed through you know, timing and hard work and all that good stuff. And there's no indication that he didn't, but hopefully he'll raise his game. But a couple of things other than Dr. Wagner losing his mask. How about that? Everybody was talking about the shoot with Sexy Star and Rosemary. And obviously, when you give your arm to someone in a match and they take advantage of you, that's ridiculous. And of course, wrestling has a long history of that. You know, not quite the same thing, but you know, the Montreal Screwjob. And also, you know, back in the day with the traveling world champions, they wanted a real world champion who had some shooting credentials. One, for credit in newspapers, but two, they didn't want someone coming in and trying to steal your belt. And one of the things that's always interesting to me about when someone does this, whenever someone does something wrong, and it's everywhere, but someone always says, well, you know, hold off your judgment. You don't know the whole story. Just wait. The whole story is going to come out. And then you kind of, you know, back off your criticism for a while, and what do you know? The whole story never comes out. So I'm willing to bet that all those people, including Sexy Star, that are saying, oh, wait for the whole story. Oh, wait. Wait for the whole story. The whole story is going to come out. I'll bet you a year from now we're still going to be waiting for that whole story, because it's really just a deflection mechanism. Speaking of shooting, John Cena and Roman Reigns and their shoot promos. Is it just me? If I become the grumpy old man, you know, it's 2:00 here on the West Coast here in the United States. And maybe I need to start eating dinner when this show is done around 3:00 my time, because I get that people were excited about it, but I'm just so over shoot interviews. I guess I'm just burned out on them. And by the way, I'm making air quotes as if I wasn't annoying enough when I say shoot interviews. I mean, I feel like for those of us who grew up in the Attitude Era and saw, you know, Scott Hall walk out on Nitro and cut a fake shoot interview and saw the whole thing with Steve Austin and Vince McMahon. And yeah, that was scripted, but everybody knew watching the show for, you know, any length of time, we knew that WCW and the WWF had been in a war forever. So it felt real. And same thing with Mr. McMahon and Stone Cold Steve Austin. We knew that Vince McMahon, we'd seen it in the past, where Vince McMahon, the promoter, tried to make his champion, you know, corporate with Diesel. And obviously, you know, it wasn't him, but with Bob Backlund and Hulk Hogan, you know, he had this mold of these champions. And it made for a great story because it was based on fact. And this whole Roman Reigns, John Cena thing isn't going to draw any money like Scott Hall did, like Austin and McMahon did, and like Vince Russo has tried a million times and never has. And I know a lot of people were praising the John Cena Roman Reigns thing. Do you think if TNA or GFW or whatever it is, FTW, whatever it is, so a GFW, if they would have done a shoot interview, do you think it would have been praised if they would have done the exact same thing? I don't know. I just feel like the era of the shoot interview is over unless it's going to be major stars like Rock. And only a guy like Rock could get away with it. And I just felt like Roman Reigns, even though he was just following orders, just isn't at that level yet. I'm bored of shoot interviews. You know who's good at it? It's Kevin Owens. Because Kevin Owens will say, oh, you look like a goof, or you look fat, or you look scared, or whatever he says. And there's an element of truth to it. But it ties into wrestling because he's talking about how he's going to use that psychology to win a match. Kevin Owens, genius. One last thing before we get to Bo James and talk about Tennessee wrestling, which I'm very much looking forward to. By the way, go to his website, The King of Kingsport. The PWI 500, the Pro Wrestling Illustrated, the one time of the year we talk about Pro Wrestling Illustrated. The PWI 500 is out. Number one, I think appropriately, is Kazuchika Okada. Is it Kazuchika? I think it's Kazuchika. I don't know. Okada is number one. And I think deservedly so when you look at the number of matches, how he's held the title, he's drawn money. He really checks all of the boxes, and he deserves to be number one. But Dan Murphy, who writes for PWI, good guy, works with my friends who write the books, Bertrand Hebert and Patrick Laprade. He works with them. But anyway, he wrote an article talking about the times where, because I didn't mention Kazuchika Okada is the first Japanese wrestler to be number one in the PWI 500. And he talks about the 1997 one, the first time when Dean Malenko was number one and Misawa was number two. For some reason, in my mind, I remember him being ranked number 10, but he was number two, which is he should have been number one. But they talk about that. And they talk about the year that John Cena was number one, and maybe Tanahashi should have been number one. And maybe it was long overdue. Because for a guy who grew up on those magazines, man, I love those magazines. I mean, it's one thing to be have the internet and be able to pull up the torch or whatever anytime you want. You know, that's nice, but there was something about that anticipation to wait for those magazines and reading them cover to cover over and over again until you got your next one. Man, I love Pro Wrestling Illustrated. It was the best. I should just get a subscription just to support them, probably, just because. I understand it's more shoot style now, but I should do that. I should do that. Anyway, the PWI 500 is out. It's always fun to debate things, but I think Okada is fair to be the number one guy, and I think that more than makes sense. So coming up, we are going to talk to Bo James, who is an active professional wrestler and probably the historian when it comes to wrestling in Kentucky and Virginia and Tennessee and the Florida Panhandle as well, anything in that sort of continental area. I think he's the guy, and we're going to talk to him coming up here in just a couple of minutes. So if you have any questions, you can dial up at 515-605-9345, or you can give us a call and do it. Give us a call, 515-605-9345, or you can tweet me at Jim Valley. And, of course, there's also email at pwtorchlivecast@gmail.com. But we're going to talk some Tennessee wrestling next with the king of Kingsport, Bo James, coming up here on the livecast next with Jim Valley on Wrestling Road Stories.
I'm Wade Keller, editor and publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter and former host here at PW Torch Livecast. If you're looking for my shows, they have moved as of July 2017. They're now called the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, available through Podcast One. Enter Wade Keller on your podcast app or iTunes and subscribe to the new Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, where I cover Raw and my first show of the week, SmackDown with my second show of the week, and then the Flagship Edition with a co-host, and we cover a broad array of pro wrestling current events, and then I end the week with a weekly interview. That's the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, now at Podcast One. Subscribe today. Just search Wade Keller.
Blues.
Hey, Bo James.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, man. It's Jim Valley. We are live here on Wrestling Road Stories on the PW Torch Livecast, man. Hey, thanks for hooking me up on this. I'm really looking forward to talking to you, my friend.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
It's great. You know, hey, I watched a bunch of your stuff that you have on your YouTube channel and seen things on your website at King of Kingsport. So how active are you these days as far as wrestling goes? I would imagine you have shows coming up right now?
I wrestled Sunday in Virginia. I'm in Kentucky tomorrow, back home, then into Virginia again Friday, then back to Kentucky Saturday, off on Sunday, off on Monday, back to Kentucky Tuesday and Thursday. And then I have a couple of days off because my wife is racing boats next weekend. So I will be at the lake watching her race.
And your wife wrestles as well, correct?
Yes.
That's amazing. So how are you able to stay so busy? Is wrestling that hot still where you live?
Yeah, it's never, you know, if you don't get booked, say, 125 to 200 times a year in the Appalachians, it's because you're not trying or you just are a complete idiot and don't know how to get booked.
That's so cool to me. That makes me so happy to hear that there's still active wrestling out there and you can actually be working that much. So you're the same. I think we're about the same age. You're like the Chris Jericho generation, right? You're kind of like a, probably started around the same time, I'm guessing.
I just turned 43 in July, and October 29th will be my 29th year in the wrestling profession.
And you started at 14.
Started at 14.
Who got you hooked? Who was the guy that you saw and hooked you?
Well, it's the family business. If you grew up in this region and you know old-time wrestling, Melvin Johnson and Zach Murray, who were wrestlers and referees for the Fullers and Crockett's and went other territories also, both of them are my cousins. So my family, through cousins and whatnot, we've been involved in pro wrestling since 1964. And watching wrestling as a little boy with my grandmother, and she would see him on TV and say, "That's your cousin right there." But my first wrestling heroes were Jay Youngblood and Ricky Steamboat.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I know pretty well his younger brother, Chris Youngblood. He just moved not that far away from me. He's a good guy.
Yeah. And I grew up at East Tennessee is very, very strange from the rest of the country, to where we were a part of two territories. We were a part of the Charlotte territory, and then we had our own home territory out of Knoxville also.
So growing up around the business, were you probably pretty smart at a young age. Were you ever a true believer?
Oh, yeah. I was a true believer the first time they put me in the ring. They assumed that I was smart because I was always around. Nobody had ever told me anything. And I got my first job. Ron West gave me my first job when I was 14, is setting up the ring, selling merchandise, promoting towns for Continental Wrestling. So my first job in wrestling, I was 14 years old working for a territory.
That's crazy. Gosh. And so
I look back at it now and just think, what a blessed life I've had.
Now, did you wrestle professionally? Did they have to put you under a mask? Did they lie about your age? How did that work?
Well, I started as a referee when I was 15. The territory had shut down, and they were still, you know, they call independent groups now, but were called outlaw groups then. And there were a couple of groups here running that were trying to, you know, keep wrestling alive. And I was helping out one ran here by a guy named Al Bass, who was the nephew of Jody Bass, who was Sam Bass's widow. And we were in a little town called McFeeters Bend, Tennessee. And it's bell time, and there's no referee. And he comes out, and he says, "You think you can ref?" I said, "You know, maybe when I grow up one day or something." And he said, "I mean in 10 minutes. And that's kind of how it started.
And you've been going ever since.
I had never looked back, and I've been booked steady ever since.
So your website is thekingofkingsport.com, and obviously that's an homage to Ron Wright.
Yes, in a roundabout way. You have to read my book, Don't Miss This, The History of Wrestling in Kingsport 1962-69, because, you know, the King of Kingsport on Ron Wright has become quite a myth over the years, and I explain it all into my book, and thanks to Jim Cornette and everything else, the true story is told in my book.
So before you came on, I was just talking about, you know, I kind of have a working knowledge, but as you mentioned, it's kind of an unusual territory, and I'm a little vague on some of it, but a couple of weeks ago, I had Brennan Martin on. He's got the book about his grandmother, Christine Jarrett. And, you know, he talks about the connection to the Goulas family and you know, all the history that you're more than well aware of, and I'm sure many people are. But it kind of piqued my interest again about East Tennessee side. And who do you think is the biggest star in the history of you know, I'm just like people call it Memphis, I'm just going to say East Tennessee just to make it easy.
Well, let's narrow it down, because East Tennessee had two offices. They had a Kingsport office and a Knoxville office. Until January of 75, there was four different territories in Tennessee. Two of them ran out of Nashville, the Nashville Inn, the Memphis Inn with Goulas Welch. Knoxville with Kazanas, who only ran 2 days a week. Then in Kingsport territory, who was owned by different people over the years, was a five-day-a-week full-time territory that ran three weekly towns, two spot shows a town, and had separate TV away from everybody else, who used talent from Charlotte and talent from Nashville, and was its own independently ran office here, and it was an NWA office. And it was started in the late 30s out of Bristol by a guy named Pete Moore, who owned appliance stores, who somehow had got hooked up with the Welches, and the Welches were supplying wrestlers, but he had opened the territory, and he knew nothing about wrestling, nothing about promoting anything than his business. He had a young man who was a salesman for him who could sell anything, and he told him, "This wrestling is yours. You take it and run with it. Just make sure we don't lose any money." And that young man's name was Jim Crockett, who would become Jim Crockett Sr. So Crockett Promotions started in Kingsport in 1939.
I don't think I knew that. That's some great information there. So if you were to say the area that encompassed, who do you think is the biggest star, the stalwart, the tentpole star of that territory?
Ron Wright and Whitey Caldwell.
That's what I figured.
And you have to put both of them side by side, because just their names alone sold buildings out here. Just their name, they would just say, like if they booked a spot show, they would run an ad in the paper that says, "Wrestling's coming to Pennington Gap, Virginia," which is a small town 40 miles from here, "Saturday night, Ron versus Whitey." They didn't even have to put their last names in there or any stipulations or anything else, and they'd sell the building out.
What do you think it was about them that drew?
Local, hometown grown sports stars. Now, you got to look, when they started NASCAR, the Bristol Raceway was in a cow pasture and it was a dirt track. It now holds 170,000 people and shown on television around the world. Knoxville UT Sports was not seen on television or heard on the radio every week like it is now. We did not have minor league baseball like we do here now. So they were the sports stars. Whitey Caldwell was the first five letterman sports star out of Kingsport. Football, basketball, baseball, wrestling, and track. He's lettered in all of those. Plus, he was a standout at the boys' club with their summertime wrestling program. So people had read about him in the newspaper before they ever turned pro. Ron was a couple years younger than Whitey, and he was Whitey's sidekick, and they had a match where they filled in for two guys that did not show up in Kingsport. It was their first time against each other in front of a sold-out crowd. Whitey hard-weighed Ron in the eye. Ron got excited and threw Whitey out of the ring so hard that he landed and broke his shoulder. So now Whitey's already getting the push as the number one babyface. Now this underneath guy's just broke his shoulder, and they had instant money in the bank right there in a program. They had to take Ron, who was normally the referee or a job guy on TV, and send him up north to work and send him over to Crockett to work to get experience to come back to work the program with Whitey when he was able to come back.
Just incredible. We're talking with Bo James, pro wrestler and probably the historian on at least East Tennessee and for the purposes of Virginia and Kentucky and the Panhandle and what have you, I'm just going to call it East Tennessee. Does that work? Is that the acceptable thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's just East Tennessee wrestling. Yeah.
Good enough. You can find his stuff at King of Kingsport. I want to take a break here real quick, and he's got this really cool thing on the front page of kingofkingsport.com. The Great American Bash, which happened 31 years ago, just a couple of weeks ago, and I want to touch base on that, and we'll do that coming up, and we'll talk even more about Tennessee wrestling. I also want to talk about just kind of the differences between working Memphis and working, say, Continental or something back in the day, and we got a lot of stuff to talk about. There's going to be a lot of ground to cover, so if you want to talk, you can dial up at 515-605-9345, or you can tweet me at Jim Valley, or a Bo is at kingofkingsport.com. Stick around. It's Wrestling Road Stories. It's Jim Valley. We'll be right back.
PW Torch Livecast listeners, I invite you to get even more of what the Torch offers by becoming a PW Torch VIP member. Not only do you get ad-free access to our website, the mobile site, and the desktop site, and access to about 30 years of our archives, including over 1,500 back issues and thousands upon thousands of hours of our audio shows going back to 2004, plus tons of retro radio shows from the 1990s. But you also get over 15 VIP exclusive podcasts per week, in addition to ad-free editions of these PW Torch livecasts throughout the week. So we take the ads out of the PW Torch livecast for VIP members and then give you over 15 other podcasts per week, including what started it all, the Bruce Mitchell Audio Show. I host that with Bruce every weekend, and we spend a couple hours talking about the biggest stories of professional wrestling and wrestling history. It's one of the longest-running weekly pro wrestling podcasts on any subject, and it's one of the main reasons people go VIP and stay VIP. Another is The Fix with Todd Martin. I host that every midweek with Todd, and we get Todd's expertise and opinions every midweek on current events in professional wrestling, not just WWE, but all promotions worldwide, including New Japan. Plus, we end every show with some expert MMA talk from the LA Times columnist and SureDog contributor, Todd Martin. And there's so much more. The Every Single Day Weight Cutter Hotline with news updates every single day, Monday through Friday. And every Saturday and Sunday, I do the Ask the Editor format of the Weight Cutter Hotline, where I answer VIP member questions in depth. And there's so much more. There's the Wayback Playback with Pat McNeil and Jim Valley, Wrestling Audio Community with Shad Radican, the WWE Future Past Show with scouting reports on prospects and a look back at the indie career of current stars, the PW Torch East Coast Cast Extended VIP Edition, the retro radio shows. Every Thursday, a new retro radio show from the 90s drops, from the early 90s or the Attitude Era. And last but not least, my in-depth Raw and SmackDown reports. You can get a full chronological rundown of every episode of Raw and SmackDown with my analysis of the show in depth every Monday night and Tuesday night. So check out details at pwtorch.com/govip. We give you a lot here at the live cast, but there is so much more. The vast majority of our work is for our VIP members, and you can become one today. Go check out details on a subscription at pwtorch.com/govip.
It's Wrestling Road Stories every Wednesday, 2 p.m. on West in the United States at pwtorchlivecast.com. And joined today by a wrestler and East Tennessee wrestling expert, Bo James. You can see his stuff and check out his books. We'll talk about those in a couple of minutes here. But go to kingofkingsport.com. And you've got something really cool on your front page, on your landing page, talking about when Crockett came to Johnson City to Freedom Hall for the Great American Bash in 1986. And you say it was one of the biggest cards ever for Johnson City.
Yeah, and it was still to this day the attendance record, because, you know, fire marshals like to enforce the rules now, where they were a little bit more lenient, you know, 30 years ago. And but, yeah, a stacked card, a loaded card, thousands of people turned away. And that was the second time that year that thousands of people were turned away. As they had another sellout in January that year of Flair and Dusty.
Now the card is stacked. They got a six man on top with Dusty and Magnum and Baby Doll against the Midnights and Cornette, Road Warriors and the Koloffs in a chain match, just all kinds of stuff, and including the NWA Championship, Ric Flair against Ron Garvin. And in one of your videos on your YouTube channel, you're doing a TV interview from not that long ago, and you talk about Garvin being one of the biggest stars of that territory of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
How big?
Other than when you start talking wrestling here, Ron and Whitey come up first, and Ron's brother Don Wright, who does not get enough credit because Don was not involved as much with Smoky Mountain Wrestling, and he doesn't have the tape library out there that Ron does. But Don and Ron as a team were wonderful, drew tons of money. But you get into the next era after those guys, and Ron Fuller and Ronnie Garvin, that's the first, and the Mongolian Stomper. But Garvin came here in the early days of Southeastern, and he got over. And I mean, he got over fast. And they just used his strength of what he was. He's a fire plug at, you know, 5'8", 220 pounds, but he was a legitimate tough guy. And they put him in the ring with guys, and he just, you know, the battles that he had with the Stomper and LeDuc and guys like that were just classic brawls and fights. Then he had the celebrated match where he pinned Andre the Giant in Knoxville, which really made him the man here. And many people thought for sure, you know, he would end up living his whole life right here in Knoxville, homestead here, like the Stomper did and a few other guys, until the split came in 79, and he went on the losing side of the split against Fuller. But Garvin was super over, and when he came back here in the mid-80s with Crockett, he was a draw here as he was, you know, in all the other places that he'd been, like Georgia. So he was used wisely in main event spots in Johnson City against Flair and against the Horsemen and other top heels.
Do you think he drew the house that night for the Great American Bash?
No, that whole card drew the house. He drew houses here. But, I mean, you look at that card, that's a Greensboro card. That's a 20,000-seat arena card. That was kind of the reward from Crockett to Johnson City for the business that they were doing here in 85 and 86, selling out with five matches. And so they said, let's give them a loaded card for the bash. And it was kind of, you know, a gift to us for being so good to their promotion.
Yeah, according to your website, kingofkingsport.com, it says the attendance was 6,300 plus and over 2,000 turned away. What about they had David Allen Coe on there? Yeah, again, it seems like a big card, but do you think they made money because they had David Allen Coe on? And a lot of times the history is that those musical guests kind of ate up a lot of the profit.
Well, I don't know how much he was making. He was not a mainstream George Jones, Waylon Jennings, et cetera, that they had used in other towns. Waylon's, you know, was a pretty underground kind of guy that, or David Allan Coe was an underground guy. So, I mean, he's making money, but and nobody's paid on guarantees at this point. They're paid off of the house. So there was money made, but it could have been, you know, it could have sold out with six matches. It could have sold out with, you know, a smaller crew, but they loaded it up for the Bash Tour.
Did Ronnie ever wrestle in the old territory when he was when he was briefly world champion for the NWA?
Yes. Yeah, he wrestled in Kingsport as the champion, matter of fact, with Flair in
Did
a non-title match. Cause they it drew better than what Kingsport had drew the couple years before that. See, Kingsport was the town for Crockett until 85. When Dusty got the book, they ran Dobbin's been in high school. Now, when you think high school, you're thinking a high school gym of 1,500, whatever. Well, Freedom Hall in Johnson City, that's Science Hill High School's gym, 6,300 seats. Dobbin's Bennett, the Buck Van Hus Dome, is the high school gym to Dobbin's Bennett, 5,800 seats. So we have arenas here, same thing in Bristol. Viking Hall is the gym for Tennessee High. It holds about 6,000 people. So our gyms here are not just your typical high school gym, but that was the place that they ran every third Sunday in Kingsport with the crew, the traveling crew with Crockett and the weekly TV. So we saw the same cards that were going to Greensboro, Roanoke, wherever else. But when Dusty got the book, he thought Freedom Hall Civic Center sounded a whole lot better than Dobbin's Bennett High School gym. So he moved to Johnson City, and it kind of abandoned Kingsport, and it kind of left a bad taste in the mouth of the people to put the matches on, and we're going every third Sunday, like myself, to Kingsport Dome.
God, that, you know, people talk about the alienation of Charlotte, but God, I guess there was a lot of alienation all around the Horn.
Not, I mean, he left the small towns that built Crockett Promotions for so many years.
We're talking with Bo James, wrestler, historian. He's probably working a match right now, I'm guessing, probably as we speak. Anyway, you can see stuff at kingofkingsport.com. One of the things is I was reading the Brennan Martin book, and your books look great, too. I'm going to have to check those out. But, you know, I really started thinking about the contrast between Memphis and, say, working for Gulas or Fuller in that sort of 70s, 80s period. I mean, like a guy like a Bill Dundee or an Austin Idol who worked both, or people who worked, you know, at a decent spot on the card. You know, what do you think are the comparisons for working? What do you think they liked and didn't like about working East Tennessee versus Memphis?
Well, I know what they did like. Short trips. The furthest trip here was, 150 miles up into East Kentucky, out of Knoxville. And guys were making $1,000 a week here in the late 70s, some of them making more than that, and they were home every night before the news went off in some of these towns. So they really enjoyed that. The other thing that they did not enjoy was East Tennessee was brutal. The action was brutal. It was physical. There was no blade here. They did not use the blade. They used the hard way, or they used Ron Wright, what he called the wedge or the chisel. And I will tweet a picture of the chisel to you. And what it was a pair of homemade nuts across his hand with a pointed diamond-shaped piece of metal welded onto that. And they would take it out, grab you in the headlock, and punch you in the forehead with it, and blood would shoot about 30 feet in the air. So people knew it was real. And that's why I can identify when I go to the Cauliflower Alley Club or the Gulf Coast Wrestling Reunion, I know somebody that worked the East Tennessee Territory as soon as I see them, because they all have that very distinctive scar in the middle of their head.
Because is it straight? Straight across? Or is that what it is?
Yeah. Up and down or straight across. They had two versions of them. I will tweet both of them to you so you can tweet them out there by listening to us.
So now, given your history in the business, were you ever on the receiving end, or did you ever attempt your own version of the chisel?
I have seen it used close and personal. And I was a kid, 15, 16 years old, and Don Wright had gave one to Rick Connors. And I tell the whole story in my history book there on Kingsport. But I was sitting in the dressing room, and I saw Rick Connors take it out. And it doesn't look much different than any other, you know, set of knucks you've ever seen used in a match. Until he peeled the tape back and I saw the diamond edge metal. And he poured alcohol, rubbing alcohol on it, and then he set it on fire to sanitize it. He then rolled it up in a towel to put the fire out. He put the piece of tape back over it and put it in his tights. Went to the ring. He used it on a young guy, and when he hit him, it was like somebody turned the faucet on. The blood started running like you've never seen.
See,
and so automatically, I knew right then, my God, I've seen this as a kid. No wonder they were bleeding so bad.
See, that's why I love doing this show, Bo. Stories like that. You have a wrestler's life, but I mean, I just live this boring life. I mean, I get to travel some, and that's great, but it's just this lifestyle with, yeah, we're just going to sanitize it. We'll set it on fire, dump some alcohol on it, and it's good. We'll call it good. That's the part of the business that it just fascinates me is just that, just the crazy stuff like this. That's just the best. So,
Sullivan said when they hit him with the chisel, it looked like a double-edged hatchet coming at his head in slow motion.
So you've got three books out right now?
Three books out now, three more to come in the next year.
So just briefly, what are, tell me about each of the books.
My first book is called Do You Want to Be a Wrestler Kid? And it's kind of my autobiography. I had planned on writing a history book because I've been doing the research for this for most of my life. But I had never planned on writing a book about myself. And I'd helped Dundee and Dutch Mantel and Jimmy Vite and a few other people with the books that they wrote, just with information and timelines and different things. And all of them kept telling me, you know what, you need to write a book. And I said, no, I don't want to. Nobody's going to buy this thing. And Dutch Mantel told me, he said, look, you've worked with everybody. Everybody in the business knows you. You've got great stories. You're a great storyteller. Write this thing. So I put a few things on social media and said, hey, would you read a book full of stories like this? And everybody went nuts for them. So I published a book. It's been out 5 or 6 years ago, and it still sells almost every day somewhere around the world. It's been a great blessing to me. You hear my whole story of starting at 14, getting in the ring at 15, becoming the boss at 16, wrestling in the Memphis territory with all my heroes, tributes to a lot of the guys and girls that I got to work with, like Sherry Martel, Wahoo McDaniels, Road Warrior Hawk, Junkyard Dog, guys that are past now, my tributes to them, my hardships and my triumphs in the business. It's a great read, I think, and a lot of people highly rated on Amazon will tell you that it is. And every week I get an email from somebody that's read it for the first time who absolutely loves it. My second book is called It Takes All Kinds, The People, Places, and Events That Make Up Pro Wrestling. And it's just 25 years of road stories, just like this show. And I write the way that I talk because I just tell the story verbally as I write it. Cause I want you to read it and think you're riding in the car with me to a town. And then the third book, which came out last year, which is the first of the Kingsport East Tennessee series, which is my labor of love to the business that I love and the men that made the business here. And I go week by week to the weekly events in Kingsport from 1960 through 69. The territory changed hands three different times during that time frame of owners. Every world champion except one came here. Riots, stabbings. Everything you can imagine. I even put the blurbs in there of the people that got arrested at the wrestling matches for jumping in the ring that week because they would run those in the paper. And I've read 100 years of newspapers in Kingsport to do this series of books. My next book coming out is the 1950s, and it's a huge book on the Welch family because they were the monarchs of the wrestling profession in East Tennessee in the 50s.
So you can check them out at kingofkingsport.com. When we come back, I do want to talk about the Gulas family. I want to talk about the Poffos and so much more. It's Bo James. I feel like I won't keep you forever, but God, we'll have to get you back on again because there's just so much ground to cover. So when you get the new book
I'm
out.
I'm here as long as you want.
What a guy. All right, maybe we'll go a little long today, but I appreciate it. But we'll definitely have you on again. There's so much knowledge. I'm enjoying this as much as I thought I would. We're talking with Bo James. We'll come back, touch on the Poffos. We'll touch on some other stuff. It's Wrestling Road Stories, Jim Valley, here each and every Wednesday. It's 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific, and we're here each and every time on the PW Torch live cast for free. So be sure to share it, tell your friends about it, and we'll come back with some more great wrestling road stories next.
When you want to know when the next episode of the PW Torch livecast is scheduled or catch up on a show you missed, check out our homepage, pwtorchlivecast.com. You can stream the latest shows right from that page, or download the show, or get a link to subscribe on a podcast app. That's pwtorchlivecast.com for the latest shows, and also catch up on shows you missed at pwtorchlivecast.com.
You know, one of the wrestlers who fascinates me, and if you read a lot of books, whether it's the Brennan Martin book, the Teeny book, or Jerry Jarrett, or a number of books, and maybe it's in one of yours too, but George Gulas. Do you know George Gulas? Have you met him?
I know him very well. I've actually wrestled for him.
Everyone talks about how he was the worst wrestler, and he killed the territory, and he was unrealistic and things like that. And there's very little of footage that I can find of him on YouTube. I've seen some of it, and there certainly is a point to that, to those claims. Do you agree with that, or do you see things in a little more subtle way?
Well, I'm probably unpopular in this opinion of George. No, George was not the greatest wrestler. But no, he was not the worst wrestler. A lot of the flack that George takes and a lot of the heat that he takes is over the hatred that his dad had from certain people. If you watch the videos of George on YouTube or the five-set disc that I have on my website of Gulas Wrestling from the 70s, people are cheering George crazily. I mean, they're behind him in these matches that are on video. And the buildings are packed. So if it was true that he killed the territory, if it was true that he was the worst wrestler, then they wouldn't have been selling out Nashville and Chattanooga every week. And you'd look at a lot of other guys that came along. Look at all the muscle heads that they pushed down our throats in the 80s that were a flash in the pan and lasted 3 weeks in the territory. George lasted several years there. And George was smart enough, if he was a booker or running his own little thing as he did at the end, he didn't make himself the main star. And he didn't even make himself a single star. He teamed himself up with somebody so he could, you know, do what was needed to be done. And I cannot say anything bad about George because he has always treated me and my wife extremely well. We went down and wrestled for him around Nashville. He's always put us in a nice hotel. He's always paid us exactly what he told us he was going to pay us before we left. Even had times where he's gave us more than he said he was going to pay us when we got there. So he's been very good to us over the years. I saw him last year at Gypsy Joe's funeral, you know, and he's always been nice. He came over and shook our hands and talked to us for a few minutes.
Yeah, it's a good perspective. I was kind of, I don't know, hoping is not the right word, but I thought maybe you'd bring some more nuance to the George Gulas story, because like I said, in every book and so many interviews in the Memphis Heat documentary, you know, it's just sort of, I guess, unfortunately for George, kind of considered common knowledge that he was just awful and was killing towns.
Well, if that's all you were ever told about him, that's what you would believe. You know, if all you were ever told about East Tennessee was Knoxville, that's what you would believe, and that's what most people believe. But then they read my book, and they come to find out, wait a minute. Even though Knoxville was the big town, it was just a town itself. The territory was actually out of Kingsport. Kingsport was the guy where the guys made their living. Knoxville was just one day a week, and then a spot show on Saturday. So Kazana's only ran two times a week.
Bo James in his website, The King of Kingsport. Another thing that's always fascinated me is the Poffo family, you know, Randy Savage, his brother Lanny, the dad Angelo, and, you know, you see the ICW TV, and were they ever successful? Did they ever draw well?
Yes. Here's how they got into power here. they were tired of working for other promoters, and the promoter they worked for in the States before they opened ICW was Nick Gulas. And they left and went to Canada to the Maritimes for the summer promotion territory that ran in the Maritimes. And they had the idea of opening up their own territory. Well, they looked and saw where could we, they were living in Nashville, so where could we make a short move, run some towns that nobody's running, and do business? And Lexington, Kentucky is where they settled on, and they, which was a short move from Nashville. It's a 3.5-hour drive. So they moved there. They got TV in Hazard, Kentucky, and then Lexington and Louisville, and they started running towns in East Kentucky that the Knoxville and Kingsport had ignored for years. They started running West Virginia that nobody ran for years. They went back to towns that the Sheik had gave up on in Ohio. Then they spread out into parts of Illinois that the Bruiser was not running. And they were successful. And they had named talent because the split in Knoxville happened about the same time that they moved to Lexington. Ron Wright, Ronnie Garvin, Bob Root, Bob Orton Jr., The Assassin, and Terry Gibbs. Trying to think who else went on. But those guys broke away and split away from Fuller over a dispute on money, which Ron Wright and Ronnie Garvin both told me many times over, we made a huge mistake. We should have never broke away from him. We should have just stayed there. But they got somebody got in their ear, and they broke away, and it killed East Tennessee because two promotions couldn't run here full time, and guys make a living because there's only so many towns to run here that you could be profitable in. So Ron Wright ends up teaming up with the Pifos, and then when he gives up after a year, he turns his towns over to Angelo. Fuller sells the territory out of Knoxville to Barnett, who then sells it to Blackjack and Flair. They don't last long, so now they're gone. So now the Pifos have Johnson City every Tuesday. They have Knoxville to run when they want to, but Knoxville was dead. They had all of East Kentucky, Southwest Virginia, all of West Virginia, and then they spread out all over the place. And they were making money because they used young talent that was hungry, and they could pay just enough to live. And then the other guys had points in the office and were making money. And it was a successful run until they tried to run against Jarrett and go head to head.
How ugly did that war get?
The one in Knoxville was very bad. You know, the newspapers printed the birth names and told everything that was going on. They would go to, when they went to court and sued each other over the belts and over a boat and over a car and everything else, they printed all that stuff in the paper, and the wrestlers just came off looking really bad. They looked like a bunch of crybabies fighting over, you know, spilled milk, and it turned them off. They got tired of it. They didn't want to hear about it.
What about, I mean, everyone's heard the story about Bill Dundee and the gun with the Pafos. Are there any other infamous or any sort of a wrestling road story regarding either the war with the Pafos or the war with Jarrett, either one?
The Pafos were just, they really were not involved deeply in the war in East Tennessee. They just were working for Ron Wright's All-Star Wrestling on days they were not running Kentucky. But, you know, like the boys here, I've heard stories of Slater carrying a gun looking to kill guys. They bought tickets and went sit in the front row trying to get them to come out across the rail to fight them in Knoxville. Death threats were made. Different guys, you know, started riding together to make sure they were never alone where they could get caught out somewhere by themselves. It was a pretty ugly year, 79 was here.
And was it Bob Roop who kind of started it? Wasn't he kind of the catalyst?
Yeah, he was the catalyst. And, you know, Ronnie Garvin told me, and this is in my 70s book, because I spent the whole spring with Garvin pretty much, making towns and doing stuff and talking to him for the book. He was on a guarantee from day one from Ron Fuller. And he said he always made that guarantee, and most weeks he made anywhere from 150 to 300 more than that guarantee. He should have never left. because Fuller had never did anything to him and had always been honest to him. He just got peer pressured into going, and he says it's the great regret of his career that he went. Ron Wright says, I should have never went. Ron had a dispute because Ron was partners with the Fullers, because they combined the Kingsport territory and the Knoxville territory to make Southeastern Wrestling. And Ron Wright felt at times he was not paid as a full partner. And instead of going to them and talking to them, he just jumped on the bandwagon and went with the others.
I'm talking with Bo James. The King of Kingsport.com is the website where you can check out all of his books and keep track of the stuff that's coming soon. Also, follow him on Twitter at King of Kingsport. We got somebody on the line. Let's go to area code 240. 240, who's this? Where are you calling from? And what do you got for Bo James?
This is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland. My question for Bo is, now when you wrestled in Kingsport, you wrestled a team called the Illuminati. They were Chris Richards and Penny Givens. Did they actually belong to the Illuminati, or at least try to portray themselves as Illuminati members outside of the wrestling business?
I really don't know. No, I don't believe they belong to the Illuminati. I just think that they thought that was a cool name and went with it.
And my last question for you is, do you think Wendell Cooley was that big of a draw? Because I heard back around WrestleMania 2, he had a show he was on that drew a large crowd, but there was also a two-ring battle royal on that show that some people thought was the reason for the high attendance. So what's your theory on that show that was held during WrestleMania?
Okay, repeat that to me one more time.
How big of a draw was Wendell Cooley?
Cooley was a big draw here. Alabama, East Tennessee, the Continental Territory, Cooley was over like Rover. He was a big draw for Ron Fuller, yes. He didn't do as well in Memphis or in Mid-South because he was a homegrown talent to the Continental Territory. He's from Milton, Florida, not far from Pensacola. He grew up on Gulf Coast and Southeastern Wrestling, so he knew the product. He knew how to get over, and he got over. And he was a big deal for Ron Fuller, yes.
I remember the first time I ever heard of Wendell Cooley was the article in one of the After mags about he was Rick Casey sometimes and Wendell Cooley other times. And I think they sort of,
yes,
in kayfabe, tried to justify, you know, why one guy was kind of a jobber and why Wendell Cooley was a star, which that's how I first became aware of him. And it wasn't long after that, I remember, I think he got a couple of matches on Crockett Television on TBS. And I thought, you know, when I saw his size and his look, he seemed to have a good size and look for the era, and I thought he'd kind of, you know, maybe do something, but it never really happened.
He got hurt. When he went to work for WCW, he was just starting to get his little push there, and he got hurt, and he was out for months, and you know, and time doesn't stop. The clock doesn't stop. Television doesn't stop. So somebody else was put in that spot, and, you know, too bad. I'm sorry. We got to move on, Wendell. And that was kind of the situation there.
I never knew that. I always wondered what happened. I didn't know if maybe he was just coming in for a one shot or what the deal was, but that's what it was. Hey, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was his knee. He had, if you see the stuff from like 80, he had a knee surgery in 88. He had to miss a few months. And then if you see him like in 89 and then his early stuff in WCW, he's got a real thick knee brace on. And I think that's what it was. He had re-injured his knee, and you know, while he was laid up, they just moved forward.
Talking with Bo James. The website is the King of Kingsport. You can check out his books there. Also on Twitter at King of Kingsport. When you come back, I do want to talk about some more of the Fullers and Continental, and talking about Wendell Cooley makes me think of a famous angle with Adrian Street. We'll talk about that and more coming up next here on Wrestling Road Stories on the PW Torch Livecast.
Hello, you people. I'm Pat McNeil. Every Sunday night, Greg Parks and I will bring you Wrestling Night in America here on PW Torch Livecast. We're on at 8 p.m. Eastern most weeks or immediately following the night's pay-per-view. We'll talk Raw, SmackDown, NXT, GFW, New Japan, Ring of Honor, WWN, and all the latest wrestling news with your phone calls. So don't miss it. Be there.
And it's Wrestling Road Stories this Wednesday and every Wednesday here on the PW Torch Livecast. I'm going to be gone the next couple of weeks. Follow me on Twitter at Jim Valley or on Facebook, Jim Valley, or on Instagram at Jim_Valley. Going to go to Asia for the next couple of weeks. And not this week. This week we'll be in Hong Kong and Shanghai. But if you like travel, follow that. That's pretty cool. But in Tokyo, we're going to hook up with Bull Nakano and some other Japanese stars. So be sure to follow the social for probably some cool pictures and some cool things that'll be happening there. And we'll have some Total Chaos recorded shows in my absence. But right now we're live. We're talking with Bo James, kingofkingsport.com, and on Twitter, kingofkingsport. What's your opinion? And I'm not a big fan. And I've had some people, like I think Dave Milliken and Mark James, they don't like this opinion of mine. But I think those Continental belts, those Burger King belts with the big spikes sticking up, I'm not a big fan of those belts. Do you like them?
Oh, I love them.
Okay.
That's my childhood. That's my childhood.
Right. I get
you
it.
You know, that's what I saw on television every week.
That's fair.
I love those belts. And I love those were the Southeastern belts, and then I love the first set of Continental tag belts that followed those that disappeared when they got the USA belts. Which I love. I loved all the belts that the Fullers had.
I'm a big belt mark. I like. Do you have a sentimental favorite belt?
The Southeastern belt that Garvin has, the red, white, and blue, that he left Fuller's territory with, and then went to the Poffos with, because that was the first that belt, and then of course the Crockett belt. Those were the first belts that I saw as a kid on TV here. So that's, you know, my earliest memories of guys fighting for those belts.
So we're talking Wendell Cooley at the belts, and I think one of my favorite angles, and maybe today it wouldn't even resonate, they wouldn't do it, or I don't know, maybe it's a hate crime today, who knows, but back then they did I think for its time a very brilliant angle where Adrian Street painted Wendell Cooley's belt pink. Can you just imagine?
Yeah, that was a lot of heat for that time period.
Well, it did get over, huh?
Yeah, it did get over. And then Wendell would win it back, and it would be white again. And then he'd lose it, and Adrian would come back with it pink again. I always wondered if they had two actual straps and they just took the plates off. I've never asked Fuller that, or Tom Pritchard, or anybody that I need to ask somebody if they actually had two different belts that they just took the plates off and put onto the pink or the white.
I'm fascinated by Adrian Street, the effeminate tough guy, and I think that's a great character. Where do you think he fits in the history of Continental Wrestling?
Oh, he's one of the top guys, one of the top draws of the Continental area and Continental era. He, when he came here, and I had saw him, we got the Memphis TV here, and East Tennessee was so blessed to have Memphis TV, Charlotte TV, then, you know, the Fuller's TV. And then at one point in time when I was a kid, I remember the Sheik had TV here for a short time where it was big time wrestling and big time country. I don't know why that was. Then the Poffo TV. So I got to see so much wrestling as a kid. But I had seen Adrian and Linda off the Memphis tape. Then I saw their run in Charlotte, and then they show up in Continental. And it was like they found a home because that's where they homesteaded. They still live in the Continental area to this day. And they were used right on as the heel or baby faces, and they drew money on both sides.
And he even had a baby face run, which I think he was a great heel and a great baby face. He's one of those guys who didn't have to change much about his act either way, and it got over both times.
Right.
He had great
opponents.
Yeah, he did. He kind of reminds me, in a way, just the way he was able to seamlessly kind of switch from babyface to heel, kind of the same way Savage did, because he still kept the great parts of his act, only now he was nice to his valet.
Yeah.
Less of a coward.
Right.
What do you think for any part of the territory, when I say East Tennessee, what do you think is the quintessential angle? What's the most legendary angle?
Well, let's back it up to when they had the separate territories.
Okay.
And I'll go through the different eras. In Knoxville, the match that people talked about for years and still talk about was Ron Wright, Whitey Caldwell in the 60s. And that was the feud. And the misconception that they wrestled each other every week, they didn't. They would wrestle a few times, few weeks in a row. Then they wouldn't touch each other for 8 months to a year. Then they would do it again because it had to be fresh. And then they had to keep it, you know, both of them strong, then wait till Whitey gets a hold of Ron. But they had a series of matches for the Southeastern belt, and they dropped the belt back and forth. And Ron put up his Pride Walking Horse, Tennessee Walking Horse, which are very expensive horses and a very expensive breed. And Whitey beat him and won the horse. And then he went on television and he said, look, I got nowhere to put this horse. I don't know anything about horses. I don't know what to do with it. So I'm going to think about it. And at the end of this program, I'll make my decision on what I'm going to do with the horse. He auctioned off the horse at the matches Friday night. And they brought an auctioneer and had a auction after the wrestling matches, and he sold Ron Wright's horse to some fan, which him and Ron made a killing off of that themselves, you know. So that was a big angle that was talked about forever. The Russian chain, the matches, which became the Tennessee chain match, when Ron brought them here, Ron Wright brought them to East Tennessee, to Kingsport. In the 60s, he had went and worked for Eddie Graham and saw Boris Malenko do a chain match, and he was looking for a match, a blow-off match for East Tennessee. So those first sets of chain matches that Ron and Whitey had here in East Tennessee were just unbelievably brutal, and I'll tweet you some pictures of those also, because they hard-weighed each other. They beat each other to death. One of the great quotes in my history book was Don Wright, Ron's brother, and he said, you know why we had those chain matches once a year? And I said, no. He said, that's all you could have them. If you had them more than that, Whitey would have killed you. He said, when you got up the next day after having that match, the length of the chain would be in your body from the head to the toe, or he beat you with that chain so bad. So that's the 60s era. The angle, without a doubt, of the 70s, the two of them, Garvin beating Andre the Giant and the Mongolian Stomper hitting Joe LaDuke in the head with a sledgehammer, which that video, I have a clip of it on my YouTube page. Those are the two big angles of the 70s, and without a doubt of the 80s, the setup in the cage match, Jimmy Golden, Ron Fuller against Bob Armstrong and Robert Fuller, where Robert turns on Bob, they beat him to death, they stretcher him out, he has to leave because it was a loser-leave-town match, and then he comes back as the Bullet.
So you think those are the biggies?
No, those are the big ones, yes.
So, question about I've heard the story of Ron Garvin pinning Andre the Giant, but did they have to keep it? You say it was a huge deal, and I could get why it's a huge deal, but was there pressure, like from Vince McMahon Sr. and such, to keep that quiet?
Just don't show the finish on TV. And it was actually a handicap match. It was a handicap match where Ronnie was working a program with Roy Lee Welch, who's a part of the Welch family, Fuller's cousin. And he had broke Roy's arm, and Roy wanted a rematch. But he said, I can't do it one-handed. So Garvin said, get a partner. I'll beat both of you. Get anybody you want. So they milked it for a couple of weeks, and he came out and said, I got my partner. He's going to be here Friday night, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah, who is it? Well, it's Andre the Giant. So everybody was for sure that Andre was just going to come in and beat Ronnie Garvin to death, and you know, and they didn't get that. And that made Garvin a legend here. And there was a tape, a full tape of the match, and Garvin had it. And when right before WrestleMania III, when they were territories and were all fighting against Vince, Garvin sent the tape to Kansas City for Bob Geigel to show that Andre had been beat before he wrestled Hulk Hogan. And the tape mysteriously disappeared. Lost in time. There's only a few minutes of footage left now. That's, you know, I have it on the Fuller set on my website, kingofkingsport.com. I have what video survived that.
Did somebody on the inside, is that the theory or the guess as to what happened to the video?
Yeah.
So there was a stooge somewhere.
somebody, the theory from Garvin and other people that know the story think it came from inside the office of somebody very jealous who he had never beat Andre, and he didn't want it shown.
Oh, wow, that's even more. See, I figured it was somebody with connections to McMahon, but oh, that's even.
No.
I don't think that's better or worse. I think that's worse. Wow.
Much worse.
That's incredible. Bo James, look, man, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but look, we'll have to get you back on again. There's so much to talk about.
Yeah.
But why don't you tell everybody one more time?
Here.
There is a lot of history, a lot of great wrestling road stories. Tell everybody again about your books, about your website, about your DVDs, what have you.
Yeah, the surviving footage. I have a 5-disc set of the surviving footage of the Knoxville territory that is on my website, KingofKingsSport. It shows It shows arena footage from the 70s, and it's got a few hours of studio TV left that survived from the dying days of Southeastern, but there's some great stuff on there, and there's actually one full episode of Flair and Blackjack's NWA Championship Wrestling, which replaced Southeastern Wrestling. They're on there. I have a 5-set Gulas disc of arena stuff from Chattanooga, Memphis, Huntsville, Birmingham, Louisville, all across the Gulas territory. It's on there. I've got some Southeastern stuff on there. I have my books on there. My books are also available on Amazon and Amazon Kindle, because I know a lot of people like to do the digital reading now. All my books are highly rated through Amazon and highly rated with people that read them, send me emails each and every week about how much they enjoy them. One real cool thing that I have on there, I have 2 CDs, audio, of early 70s Knoxville interviews where a guy had held up a tape recorder to the TV and taped Luthez, Ron and Don Wright, Jimmy Kent, the Bounty Hunters and Jim Lancaster, and a lot of other guys on there. Some great audio of listening to that and hearing Ron Wright and Don Wright giving Big Jim Hess such a hard time each and every week. Those CDs are on there. And I have a Legends of Kingsport DVD that comes with, you'll buy the book, just make a note that you listen to me on this program. If you buy the history book from the 60s, I'll throw the DVD in for free. And it's 2 hours looking at the career of Whitey Caldwell, Ron Wright, Don Wright, Tony Peters, Ron West, Melvin Johnson, a lot of guys that come out of this territory.
That's incredible. You can find it at kingofkingsport.com. Also, your YouTube channel is also King of Kingsport, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and,
of course,
you can find me on Twitter at King of Kingsport. You also can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/ProWrestlerBoJames, all one letter, BEAU. Everybody misspells my name the first time, and I put a lot of stuff up on there also.
Well, I knew this was going to be great, but I've enjoyed it even more than I thought I would. And as I was researching everything today, watching some of your YouTube channel, the King of Kingsport YouTube channel, you know, I watched some of your TV and radio interviews you did, and I got to say, you're such a great representative of wrestling. You're so composed and well spoken. And, you know, given how wrestling has been portrayed at times in the media, and sometimes wrestlers honestly don't portray themselves very well in interviews, I think you do a really good job, and I think you're a great ambassador, is what I guess I'm trying
to say. Thank you very much. I've got a video I'm still working on. It's mostly audio. I'm going to put it on my YouTube. It's audio, but I'm going to put some old pictures over it as it goes, of me and Les Thatcher talking about the East Tennessee territory. It's about an hour long. And it's a tremendous, you know, it's just two guys that love this territory telling stories and talking about that. And that's going to be on my YouTube very soon, along with some other rare stuff that I've got I'm getting ready to put up. And then, also do a facebook.com/Southeastern Continental Wrestling. And that's just a tribute to the territory where I post old cards, rare pictures, a lot of pictures I took at ringside. I put stuff up there, programs that I saved when I sold as a kid. So, you know, not only do I research the history, a lot of it I kept myself, and I put a lot of stuff up there to show people the rich history of this part of the world.
And what any shows you want to promote? Any big shows?
Well, coming up, Appalachian Mountain Wrestling, we started a year ago out of Hazard, Kentucky, last September. And we have been on two small cable outlets over there in East Kentucky. Starting this Saturday, we are going to be on WYMT 57.2, the Heroes and Icons. And I'm so proud to be a part of the Channel 57 family because they are the station that carried ICW and the Knoxville wrestling and Kingsport wrestling. So the history of wrestling on that station goes all the way back to as long as they've been on the air. And we debut on there this Saturday at noon. And our first taping for that station will be Saturday night in Happy, Kentucky, which is right outside of Hazard. It's 10 miles or less from downtown. YMT crew will be there taping. We're moving from cable to broadcast TV there in East Kentucky, which will open us up to 44 counties, 230,000 households in four states, and I'm real excited about that. And then we're running Jackson, Kentucky tomorrow night, and you can just follow us on Appalachian Mountain Wrestling on Twitter and on Facebook. Keep up with us, and we also put our shows on YouTube each and every week so you can see the weekly TV wherever you're at in the world.
You know, man, you are a throwback, and I mean that in a good way, to all the hustling and running the roads and everything. Bo James, thanks so much for being here. Follow him at King of Kingsport. We look forward to seeing the tweets of the chisels and all the stuff you promised, and we'll be sure to retweet that out for everybody listening to Wrestling Road Stories today.
All right. I appreciate it. I'm happy to come back anytime. Just let me know, and I love talking about the history of the men and women that made my profession such great. I've never had another job. This is the only – everything that I've ever done, writing books, producing TVs, everything has been – the nucleus of that is pro wrestling, and it's been good to me. The Lord has blessed me through it. I've survived car wrecks. I've survived riots. I've survived downtimes in the business. I've been able to survive and say, hey, I'm a pro wrestler, and that makes me very proud.
Oh, James, thanks for being here. We'll get you on again. So much to cover, but thanks. Check him out at all the social platforms at King of Kingsport, and check out his books as well. And remember, if you buy, what was it, the 60s book? Is that the one?
If you buy the 60s book, I'll throw the Legends of Kingsport DVD in free for you. That way you can see guys in action like Whitey Caldwell and Ron Wright. You won't see anywhere else. Very rare footage, and you'll get to see who you're reading about in action.
All right, man. Thank you so much. We'll get you on again. I've really enjoyed
Thank
this.
You.
The great Bo James, everybody. All right, I'm gone for the next couple of weeks. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at Jim Valley or Instagram. And thank you, by the way, to Matthew Hender for following me. I see that. Adrian Christopher, and there's Eduardo. There's a bunch of people, so thank you for that. Be sure to follow me, and we'll tweet out some pictures of me with Bull Nakano and Fumi Saito and some other great stuff from Tokyo. Also, we'll probably go to Ribera Steakhouse, and we'll probably hit Budokan and all kinds of great wrestling stuff in Tokyo, and I'll tell you all about it coming up in 2 weeks. So Total Chaos Radios for the next 2 weeks, including next week with J. Michael Kenyon. So remember, until next time, stay safe, be proud of being a pro wrestling fan, and remember, as always, you don't have to be white to be white trash. See ya!
This is life.